Patrick Mullins announced his arrival as the best political biographer in this country by writing the life of one of our worst prime ministers, Billy McMahon. I was one of those who picked up a copy of Tiberius with a telephone and wondered, why bother? Until I began to read Patrick's portrait of Billy McMahon and this country at the fag end of 20 years of coalition rule. It won all the prizes and deserved to. Mullins has now written another beautiful biography of an unlikely figure, this time Richard Marr, a scandal-plagued Sydney lawyer turned politician around the time of Federation. He's what my mother would call one of the meagre Marrs, M-E-A-G-H-E-R, Irish, Catholic, no relation. Marr's downfall and struggle to climb out of the pit he dug for himself entertained the nation. Mark Twain, visiting Australia at the time, called it a two-volume novel in itself, a tale worthy of Balzac. Well, Balzac, already dead, long dead by that time, has left the task to Patrick Mullins, who's now written The Stained Man, A Crime, A Scandal, and The Making of a Nation, just published by Scribe. Patrick, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks, David.
Why spend the years you've spent writing the life of this barely known man?
I was intrigued by what I saw as the really contemporary parallels and resonances of his story. Over the last couple of years in particular, I think we've had this kind of parade of stained people, men who've done terrible things usually, and parade across the public stage afterward as though they're martyred and scapegoated and being persecuted. They turn kind of those marks of social censure into badges of honour. And when I found out about Marr and I began reading about him, all I could see were these constant echoes and resonances. So I thought this was a way to kind of understand how and why figures who've done terrible things manage to stay on the stage and to do so without inviting a libel suit, which is a pretty useful thing.
Because God knows the man's been dead for nearly a century. Patrick, when we're writing biography, it's always in a sense because it says something about today, isn't it? Isn't that why you write a biography? Yes, it talks about then, but it has to also talk about now.
Absolutely. I mean, biography, I think, is a really interesting genre for this very reason, because the questions you ask of a subject constantly change. I think some of the people who wrote about Marr in earlier years, like Cyril Pearl back in 1958 with Wild Men of Sydney, was asking different questions to the questions we have today. I was interested in this story for Marr about the contemporary parallels, but also things like the role of gender and the way that informed Marr's actions and his disgrace. I was interested in the nation-making dimensions of his story as well, the way he managed to intertwine his cause with the making of this nation-state. We always do write about the present, and we always do understand it, the past through the lens of the present. And that's really a good reason why biographies shouldn't be left to stand alone. They should kind of be rewritten and rewritten over and over again. And, you know, for any evidence of that, you just look at the number of biographies of Churchill that we see. They're constantly being rewritten, constantly new questions and constantly new answers.
For today.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Okay, Dick Marr walks into a room. What do we see?
We see a tall man, dark hair, thick set, big plump lips, a thin beaky nose and a very pronounced philtrum. If you don't know what that word is, then it's the line between your lips and nose. He is very well dressed. He is also incredibly eloquent. He's grandiloquent in expression. His sentences are grand. They march onwards in this kind of circuitous rhythms, but always to a beautiful full stop that rouses listeners and rouses juries.
His eloquence is one of the themes of this book. And I wonder whether one thing has absolutely changed between then and now, and that is the power of the great eloquent political address. So much part of that time, but not now.
Absolutely. I mean, oratory is what has brought so many political figures to prominence in this country. You know, you think of Alfred Deakin, for example. He came to prominence first and foremost through his oratory, just because he was such a good public speaker. And we're talking, of course, about a time when people were out and about in the streets, in meetings, going to Parliament, going to the courts, in far more, you know, plentiful number than they do today. And so that talent became really noticeable, and it became a big part of how you could garner appeal. A journalist in the 1920s, looking back on Ma, kind of wrote that in Australia, one thing you need to be successful is the ability to talk. And Ma could talk and talk and talk and just keep talking. It is a real, very big difference to today. I think most of our politicians today speak in much shorter time spans and without as much depth and in some ways without as much colour and fire as Ma could bring to public meetings.
Because in those days, political addresses of these kind were a public entertainment.
Absolutely. And they were alive to that. I mean, one of Ma's, you know, my favourite line that I found of Ma saying was when he was rounding on a newspaper editor and he called him, "You skunk, you scaly, scrofulous bit of carrion. You can't grow eyebrows, you diseased creature." I mean, imagine hearing someone say that today, you know, in a courtroom or on a podium or something. You'd be, wow, you'd be rooted to the spot. And Jack Lang, you know, famously Labor Premier in the 1920s, kicked out of office by the Great Depression, but pointed out that that's what people wanted. They wanted colour in politics. They wanted that ferocity of daily language. And, you know, if I might speculate for a moment, I think it's one of the reasons why Donald Trump is something of a compelling presence, because he just has that ability to speak so plainly.
And even if he's contradicting himself every 10 minutes, nevertheless, there's some public entertainment in it. At those big meetings, this is an old question of mine, and I'm fascinated by its possible answers. At those big meetings, when there were thousands of people packed into a great big hall, there's no amplification. How many people can actually hear the speech?
That's a great question to ask. I don't have an answer, to be honest. I would understand that these people are accustomed to speaking in big public spaces and that they would have to have the lungs and the diction and the diaphragm to project that. But one of the things that's really noticeable about it is that even if they can't hear it, the people are able to sense the atmosphere that's created and able to join into it. I mean, the newspaper reports you can look back on from this time are just replete with colour of heckles and whistling and singing, all of it bubbling up and creating this enormous atmosphere of a common feeling.
And if you didn't get the gist of what was happening at the meeting, you can read about it next day in the newspaper because the whole thing is reported.
Absolutely. Maybe even that evening, one of the afternoon or evening papers.
The other thing is, you mentioned the lungs. Have you heard recordings of Curtin speaking?
I've heard a couple. They're kind of, they're interesting, aren't they? They're not what you expect.
No, but the lungs are magnificent. And obviously, here is a man used to speaking at union meetings and on, you know, at street meetings, and he had to be heard.
Well, I think it's the same thing they said of Chifley, that his gravel voice was because he'd exhausted it so much speaking on the soapbox.
But Dick Maher was splendidly eloquent his entire life and came up with such wonderful expressions. What about his description of Australia as a wild dreamland of desolation?
Yeah, it's an evocative description of it, isn't it? I mean, it's wholly of its time in the sense that it doesn't see the beauty of the country and it doesn't see the First Nations peoples who were here before the arrival of the Europeans. But for him, you know, this was a kind of unplumbed land where great explorers would go in, plunge into the wilderness and explore and find things and come back. And he would speak about people in these grand heroic terms. It fitted with his outlook for Australia, but also his outlook on himself.
Yes. He saw himself as one of these heroes.
Absolutely.
Well, he was a poor Irish kid, and by the path provided by the church through Catholic schools, he became a lawyer. And in 1895, he defended a Sydney ferry captain, George Dean, charged with attempting to poison his wife. Now, Dean lost. What happened then?
So in the courtroom, when Mark was given this defence of George Dean, Mark quickly seized on the idea that Dean was the victim of a stitch-up, that his wife, Mary, and mother-in-law, Caroline Seymour, were in some kind of a dark conspiracy to bring down this heroic ferryman. And I really need to stress the fact that Dean was thought to be a hero. He was known to a wide number of people in Sydney through his job on the ferry, and he was a known lifeguard and had saved people from drowning in Sydney Harbour.
And, Patrick, he was very handsome.
very handsome. We shouldn't underestimate the importance of good looks.
No, never.
So in the courtroom, Ma advanced this claim that Dean was being stitched up. The jury in the courtroom didn't believe it. The judge in the courtroom didn't believe it. But the public at large outside the courtroom, hearing of Ma's claims, sensing some of the darker things about Mary Dean and Caroline Seymour that Ma had managed to uncover and put into the courtroom, but also concerned by the judge's interventions in the jury deliberations, decided that the verdict at the trial must be unjust. They started calling it, the newspapers started calling it a decided injustice, saying that the jury had been browbeaten. The Telegraph called it a terrible miscarriage. Truth newspaper, ironically named, called it a wicked conspiracy. And so there immediately arose this agitation. And when I say immediately, I mean within the week of this trial concluding, you were starting to get meetings all over New South Wales, hundreds of people attending them, all over Sydney, even thousands of people eventually attending them, demanding that the government intervene and somehow work out what had really gone on in this court case.
But Ma knew that the verdict was just. And yet he continued to agitate for a royal commission into the behaviour of the judge, really.
Yeah. So Ma went to see Dean in Darlinghurst Jail. He went there at the behest of his partner, a guy named Paddy Crick, or Billy Crick, as Ma called him, who was a member of Parliament and his law firm partner. And he went there and he said to Dean, you know, I'm just going to play a trick on you. The police have found the poison. The game's up. They want to know now where you got it from. They want to know the full story. And Dean fell for this little trick and he confessed everything. Now, Ma always said later that he was kind of torn apart, torn asunder as to whether he should upset the verdict or whether he should just let things remain as they were. But he rationalised the idea that he should continue fomenting a big public campaign, agitating the public. He rationalised it on basis that he had a duty as a solicitor to his client to stay silent. He rationalised it in context of his opposition to the death penalty. At that point, Dean was sentenced to hang. And he rationalised it too that evidence at the trial and the judge's interventions were improper and that Dean had not had a fair trial.
Okay, now, a question. Why on earth did Ma do that? I mean, as we all know, lawyers go to enormous lengths not to know their clients are guilty. Why did he go to the jail and confirm that the man had, in fact, tried to poison his wife? Why?
He never provided an explanation. Never, ever. He'd been ostensibly just dispatched to the jail by his partner, Crick, to say to Dean, look, if you did this, then we should let things stay as they are and you may get off. You know, you might have your sentence reprieved and you'll be able to live in the state's care. But if you go on with this and you absolutely, you know, if we find confirmation that you did this, confirmation that you are guilty, then the full weight of the state will be brought upon you. And Ma never explained
why.
He never explained why.
This campaign on behalf of the client he knew to be guilty meant attacking a judge, William Windia, who I take it is the father of the Windia legal family, but is still going strong. But this man was a figure of the establishment, much respected amongst lawyers, but there was Ma clawing him down, and it worked.
It did. It's worth saying Ma was also seizing upon and playing on fertile ground. Windia was a figure of controversy. He had, in some ways, been central to the furore that brought down Sir Julian Salomons, the Chief Justice appointed in 1886, who never actually sat on the court. He was also really, really controversial for his interventions during the Mount Rennie trials, wherein a number of men who were accused of gang raping a young woman were tried and convicted at a trial that is just bizarre in its urgency and the length of the sittings that were given to it. So Windia was thought to be quite brutal, quite callous, and he was enormously controversial. So when this disquiet about the verdict came out and when reports were made of the judge's interventions with the jury, people were really ready to take up Dean's cause, to agitate against Windeyer, to agitate against the government, and call instead for this man to be set free or to have the whole thing reopened again. And there's, of course, enormous gender prejudices going on at this that we should talk about because I think they're really important.
Yep, but first, let's just say it worked and Dean was freed. And it might have stayed there. I mean, something that had sort of caught up the whole of Australia with this extraordinary furor. It was, a great public event. It might have just stayed there, except that Mark couldn't keep his mouth shut.
No. It's the one bad thing about, being a man of great abilities is you feel the need to tell everyone that you're a man of great abilities. After the Royal Commission had been called, after Dean had been freed, after Ma had effectively pulled off this dark conspiracy to free a guilty man, decided to stand for election to the parliament. The government had gone to the polls and Ma decided to stand at it. And that brought for the first time a bit of political heat on him. The Daily Telegraph newspaper said, well, look, if Ma was such a great lawyer, such a great guy, he should have gotten Dean off in the first place. We shouldn't have needed this Royal Commission that's cost us thousands of pounds. We shouldn't have needed this. Ma decided he was going to sue for libel. And
Oh, Patrick, how many careers have been brought undone by the decision to sue for libel? Continue.
As you do when this happens, Ma decided to go and see the opposing Crown Counsel at the Royal Commission. The person I mentioned just earlier, Sir Julian Salomons, who was a leader of the Sydney Bar. And Ma decided to consult him about this. And he said, I'd like to sue the Telegraph for blaming me for not getting Dean off at trial. And Salomons not unreasonably said, well, if you were any good, you should have got him off at trial. To which Ma said, oh, but of course Dean was guilty. So I've managed to do this wonderful thing. Salomons weighed this secret. It was a secret. He realised he'd been trapped into silence of client confidentiality, wrestled with it for a couple of months, but it managed to leak out just through little bits of conversation with other people.
Well, he talked to the Attorney General, didn't he? So that was that was a surefire way of leaking it out. I mean, perhaps we should emphasise that what Ma had owned up to was a profound violation of his obligations as a lawyer.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, one of the things to say about this is that Ma always thought his duty to his client was paramount, that's the first duty. But of course, as any solicitor today would tell you, the first duty is to the court. Yeah, the overriding duty is to the court. It's not to your client. So, for that reason, you don't ask your client if they're guilty or innocent.
So word got out, and after sort of trying to weather the huge storm that broke over him, Ma confessed and owned up and was struck from the roles of solicitors.
Yes, after a very dramatic, it should be said, we talked about speechifying before and oratory, grand parliamentary speeches where Ma was in Parliament making a speech, his partner Billy Crick was in Parliament making a speech, Sir Julian Salomons is in Parliament making a speech, and really, I mean, amazing speeches to read. Salomon's speech ran for 4 hours, and according to contemporaries at the time, everybody was absolutely enthralled. And what's also notable about those speeches, I think, is that you see all these prejudices being pulled out and kind of played with and acknowledged and contested.
The prejudices being?
In particular, anti-Semitism in this instance. Salomons was Jewish, and his Billy Crick said of him that he was, an anti-Semitic cur, railed against him, said that he was ambitious and lying, that he was in the vestiges of mental lunacy, all of these kinds of things, and which invited, when Salomons replied and dispelled all these lies and all this attempts to smear him, Salomons came back and owned exactly the fact that he was Jewish. He said, I am a Jew. I was born a Jew. I hope I shall die a Jew. I should be a poltroon and a coward as well as a fool if I were not proud of belonging to a race which has given an Isaiah to the world, the Psalms of David, and all the mighty mysteries of the Bible upon which the civilization, the consolation, and the happiness of the world depend.
Wow. And there was the other prejudice, which I alluded to when quoting my mother, which was prejudice against Catholics.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the sectarianism that we can think about today, it's largely vanished from Australian, modern Australian life. But back then it was pronounced. It was enormous. Ma, a Catholic, was to some extent on the receiving end of bits and pieces of it. It didn't really figure in this part of his career, but it certainly did in later years.
But the thing is that this person is now ruined, apparently ruined. I mean, he has to resign from Parliament. He is apparently ruined.
He's plunged down into the abyss of shattered hopes and broken ambitions,
beautiful,
he says.
Beautifully put. But he climbs out. Now, on ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live, I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to Patrick Mullins about his book, The Stained Man, just published, The Life of Richard Maher. So, Patrick, you say, you know, the subtitle of your book is The Making of a Nation, A Crime, A Scandal, and The Making of a Nation. What was Maher's role in the making of the Federation?
He had a really interesting role, I think. In 1899, George Reid, then Premier of New South Wales, was putting to voters in New South Wales the draft constitution at a referendum and saying, look, vote this up and New South Wales can go into it. Maher was an advocate for Australia going into Federation, and in service to that, he stumped across the state for it. One of the most notable things he did was he went up north to his electorate by then, around Byron Bay and Woolloomba, and followed the Labor parliamentarian and a very notable orator himself too, William Holman, and would go and preach about the virtues of Federation and why people should vote yes, right after Holman had gone there to say, this is why you should vote no. He then also came back to Sydney, and Sydney at this point was the locus of kind of anti-Federation sentiment in New South Wales. People didn't want it there. And Maher spoke all over the city at all these town meetings at various corners, you know, and it should be said the feeling was vociferous. At one meeting, some people wheeled in this cart covered with a tarp, and they pulled off the tarp at one point, and they found there was a figure of George Reid gussied up to be in a noose, and then they lit the whole thing on fire with kerosene. So Maher was there stumping in favour of Federation to this audience that in some ways didn't really want it.
Why didn't they want it? Why was New South Wales so opposed to the notion of an Australian nation?
Well, the big part of it, I think, was economic. There was, you know, Sydney at this point was the centre of free trade in particular, and all the other colonies that were coming together were protectionist in outlook and nature. You know, this is the source of Reid's famous comment that setting up an Australian federation with the other colonies to be like going in as a sober man trying to go in with a house full of drunkards. So that's the main reason for why New South Wales was so wary of Federation. But Maher helping, you know, his efforts to go to bring about Federation in New South Wales were one of the first reasons one of the first ways that he began to recover his popularity. You know, a whole range of the political elite in New South Wales, you know, disdained him, thought him disgusting, thought him a reprehensible character. Nonetheless, their hearts began to soften as they saw this man helping to transform the country and transform them too, you know, taking them from being mere colonials, in fact, to being citizens of a new country. And one of the arguments I make in the book is that Maher constantly manages to entwine his cause with this broader one of the nation. You know, as one of his contemporaries said of Maher, Australia is essentially a country of new beginnings for individuals as well as institutions. Men are judged solely on their actions of today. Those of 20 years ago are charitably forgotten. If Maher's encouraging that kind of culture, he's encouraging then people to think, well, what he did in the Dean case, let's just forget about that. Doesn't matter.
But the Dean case never dies because Maher keeps going back to the lawyers and saying, readmit me as a solicitor. And he's doing it again and again and again. Every time it brings back the scandal of the Dean case, and every time he's refused.
Yeah, he goes back to the courts, I think it's 8 or 9 times in the end, attempting to get back on the role of solicitors. But there's a long period there, after he had gone to the courts and been put back on the role very briefly, where the High Court intervened and threw him back off the rolls. After that, for the next 5 or 6 years or so, Maher decided instead that he was going to find power and validation and recognition through Parliament, that he was going to climb the greasy pole. And that coincided with him joining the Labor Party and quickly quickly becoming a really notable and influential force within the party, particularly the State Party.
Speaker of the Parliament. Hey, but Patrick, before we get to him joining the Labor Party, one of the things that really interested me in the book is to be reminded about the Progressive Party. Ma was a progressive, capital P, but that party petered out. Why? What did it mean to be a progressive?
Well, it's worth saying progressive was the new name applied to the protectionists. So after Australia federated, a whole host of concerns that had initially divided the colonial parties were basically taken out of the state arena. So the responsibility for tariffs and so on, you know, that all went to federal politics. So the dividing line between free traders and protectionists were gone. And after that, the parties rebadged themselves. The protectionists became progressives, as you say. The free traders became liberals. And Labor, of course, which is gathering steam this whole time and building itself into a potent political force, remained Labor. Ma, though, was never actually properly a part of the progressives or indeed the protectionists. He was always kind of on the outer of the party, and his independence from it was one of the really notable things about him. He always said, I'm not a party man. I'm always, you know, fighting on my own battles. I have the strength of mind to stand on my own. And he maintains that right up until the point that he joins Labor.
So Ma is now cutting a big figure in Sydney and in New South Wales. He's the Speaker of the Parliament. He becomes Lord Mayor of Sydney.
At the same time.
So he's a big figure. Is he received at Government House, however?
It is clear by the time he became Speaker, he was received at Parliament House. Government House. There was a newspaper article I found saying that the sight of him toddling off to be received by the governor, you know, in his fine morning dress was the sight of much mirth. But it's worth saying that before this, back in 1912, the prospect of him becoming a minister and having to be received by a governor of New South Wales prompted a government to intervene in politics. Baron Chelmsford, within days of realising that Ma was a candidate to become a minister, called the leader of the Labor Party, James McGowan, and William Holman as his deputy, and said, this gentleman's past are of the worst reputation. If he becomes a minister, I cannot receive him at Government House. You need to intervene. And they did.
Yep.
They did. They knocked him out and kept him from it. Ma becoming Speaker of the Parliament was completely out of Holman's control and, in fact, contrary to his wishes. It speaks volumes for Ma's success as a political force that he managed to gazump in a ballot for the speakership that just removed Premier James McGowan, the former Labor leader.
Now, I think listeners can already hear one of the qualities of the book that I enjoyed so much. You just love the texture of these times, don't you, Patrick? You love the intrigue, the betrayals. We haven't even talked about the horsewhipping of the editor of The Truth in the streets, but you love the kind of rawness and shamelessness of this time.
I do. I mean, it's extraordinarily colourful. It's extraordinarily vital. You can see so many of the social causes and concerns of the time in there. But, you know, I think it's worth saying one of the things that attracted me to this story too was the possibilities and the challenges of trying to dramatise it. I'm really interested in narrative nonfiction and how you can make a work of history and a work of nonfiction as compelling as a novel. You know, with all the sensory details, the smells, the sounds, the dialogue, the characters, thrusting and ambitious as they are, violent and vile too as they are, that stuff just interests me. And the politics in this time are extraordinary to read about. They're profoundly different to today. And one of the difficulties I had when I was writing about it was getting my head around the difficulties, the values of these people and what their blinkers were. You know, they're amazing to read about because they also do have such contemporary resonance and contemporary parallels.
One of the things that the book reminds us of is the huge split within the labour movement caused by the First World War. And it's so dramatic around Ma because this guy is an Irish kid. He has, as I said, climbed the ladder that the Catholic Church provided for these bright kids. He's a lawyer, he was briefly anyway, he's a politician, all of these things. He sort of believes in Irish independence of some kind, but when it comes to it, in the First World War, He absolutely backs Britain. Now, what is it about the progress of a man from his beginnings to this time that he waxes lyrical about Britain? He supports the referenda to conscript Australian men to go to war. He becomes an empire man. What is it in him that allows such a trajectory?
It is a contradiction, really. I think it comes down to a yearning for him to have all the status and the esteem of the establishment. And, you know, the establishment at this time is British. It's just British in nature. It's Protestant. It's all these organisations, institutions, which harbour privilege and power. But there is a contradiction in it. And I think, you know, you could talk about Irish-English dichotomy there, but I think the Irish part of him wanted to fight respectable opinion, wanted to fight the establishment, but at the same time wanted to enjoy the privileges of it too and the powers of it. One of the things that I found really interesting when I was researching and writing the book was how keen Ma was for fighting the First World War. He was always an aggressive figure, always ready for a fight. But his, you know, almost bloodthirstiness at points is really notable. When he was trying to drum up recruits for the First World War, he talked constantly about how you couldn't just fire a few bullets into the German beast. You would need to pour molten lead into them. He talked at another point about a little bit of poetry that kind of, I think, makes the blood run cold. He said, every enemy bullet in every Australian body is but another rivet between motherland and the new. You know, profound kind of empire on one hand and building that into it, but at the same time, this pugilism and aggressiveness and a faith and a belief that bloodshed was the way you made a nation and you sharpened character.
And so the Labor Party split between those who were willing to back the empire with conscription and those not. What happened to him in the split? Where did he go?
Ma won and lost. As he said later, beforehand he'd been a demigod in the Labor movement. Afterward, he was a demon. On one hand, he managed to secure another term as Lord Mayor of Sydney. The people who had voted against him exactly 1 year before completely changed sides and voted against him, whereas those who'd voted against him the year before completely swapped sides and voted for him to keep him on for another year.
Yep.
But then an election followed in 1917 and his constituents in Sydney, Labor constituents, threw him out of office.
Yep. Now, a great example for us all, but I wonder, you know, what we can point to that says, you know, Ma did this. And I wonder whether there's anything much more than him stopping Market Street being extended through Hyde Park.
Look, this is one reason why Ma thought himself a favoured Catholic son, and I think it's why he enjoyed the esteem of the local Catholic Archbishop. Look, as Lord Mayor, Ma's tenure is really most noticeable for his efforts in behalf of the First World War. I think he would talk about changing the rates charged on unimproved land, but, you know, beyond that, as a significant political figure, there's not much, really.
Yeah, but as an illustrative figure of the time, so powerful. And I wonder whether I'm coming at this from my own experience as a journalist about this country. I mean, you see his career as an example of fresh beginnings. We should say, of course, that by this time he had been readmitted to the solicitor's role by a most extraordinary method. What was the method, Patrick?
An act of parliament.
Yes.
Literally a one-line bill, unlike anything we'd ever seen before and has never been repeated since, introduced into the parliament to override the state Supreme Court, and indeed, really, the New South Wales, the High Court of the country, to put Ma back on the role as the solicitor.
So he's back, and you see this as an example of a country of fresh beginnings, a country where past sins can be forgotten. But I wonder whether it's an example of a country where if you are determined and if you are shameless, you can overcome your own past.
I think that's probably a fair reading. I mean, I think Ma's restoration to the roles is unfortunate. so many of the people speaking in his favour talked at the time, oh, you know, we need to forgive people. We're a Christian country. The fact that his bill was moved near Christmas said, you know, it's a time of forgiveness. Let's forgive. I kind of disagree with that. You know, perhaps there's a Catholic education in me, but I certainly think that forgiveness is there for anyone who asks it. But the salient point is you need to actually ask for it. You need to recognise that you have done something wrong. And Ma never, ever did. He never recognised, never admitted, acknowledged that he had brought the world crashing down on Mary Dean and her mother. I mean, smearing them as prostitutes, yes, as degenerates, all this stuff. That he had brought public confidence, shaken the public confidence in institutions of the courts and government. You know, he never acknowledged the profound damage he had done in this. And that failure to recognise that spoke, I think, to a moral twist in him that underlied why the courts would not admit him, because they didn't trust that he would not repeat himself, that he would not do the same kind of thing again.
Well, he had a brief career again as a solicitor, defending crooks without, I think, Patrick, without any controversy?
Pretty much. He was involved in two very notable cases, both with Doc Evatt, in fact, over immigration and or attempts to deport militant trade union officials.
And the book has these figures in it, who were still operating when I was a young man. I mean, there's Eddie McTiernan, Attorney General of New South Wales, who ended up on the High Court and finally was booted off the court by Barwick when he was, 93 or something. And there's Doc Evatt. He left money to Doc Evatt in his will.
He did. He left money to Doc Evatt. He also left money to a really famous slippery character named Daniel Green, a kind of fixer in the Labor Party, but also something of a runner and very dubious character in Sydney criminal circles too.
Well, I'm not sure, Patrick, whether you should be praised for bringing back to Australian consciousness, as you inevitably have with this splendid biography, this shyster, this eloquent shyster, there to entertain us. But here it is, and you've done it. And I think you should be ashamed of yourself.
I'll go to confession straight after the interview, David.
Thank you, Patrick, if you wouldn't mind. I've been talking to Patrick Mullins, author of this splendid biography of an extraordinary man, Dick Maher, as he was known, no relation, let me once again emphasise, The Stained Man, A Crime, A Scandal and the Making of a Nation, which has just been published by Scribe. And it's very entertaining. This is Late Night Live.